This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about eating disorders with Daniel O'Boyle, who alongside two other men was recently featured sharing his experience in this area on the RTE documentary Unspoken. And before I get into anything more about the guest or indeed our usual stats for this episode, you'll also notice that it is just me in today's intro. Danielle will be back to joining me very soon, but in the meantime with this slightly delayed episode, you've got a solo intro, so I will probably speed through the stats and such. It's a bit less organic to be reacting to stats that you have also researched than it is to have a more free-flowing conversation when there's two of you there. And I guess, to be fair, if we start getting into me talking to myself, we really will be here all day. But I've still got some stats to go through, and these are all picked from the documentary I mentioned as well. So 1 in 4 people with eating disorders are male. This was cited in the HSE Model of Care for Ireland report of 2018. And this one I thought was particularly notable because this is the highest prevalence stat I've ever seen for eating disorders in males. I've previously seen 1 in 7, I've previously seen 15%, which are about equivalent to each other. So I think this one is particularly notable because it feels a lot more realistic to what I see in terms of prevalence out in the world, and perhaps accounts for a greater proportion of people that would have previously gone undiagnosed. Because as we know with these conditions, and indeed many mental illnesses, the symptoms can present differently depending on gender, depending on ethnicity, depending on age. A whole range of factors can play into just what those symptoms look like. So even if you have the symptoms to be diagnosed with a condition, they may be harder to spot. They may fit a less stereotypical idea of how that particular condition may present. And even in medical communities, this kind of stereotyping around who is affected by particular conditions can still exist. And in the interview, actually, our guest Daniel does share one of those experiences, which is, you know, frustrating to hear, but good stat there for prevalence that, yes, feels a bit more realistic. Next up, 2021 saw an increase of over 100% in men seeking help from Bodywise, the Eating Disorder Association of Ireland. And this is one that, as I guess a glass half full type person, I try to see the positives in stats like this. As shocking as that increase is, hopefully it is partly a sign of how many more people are coming forward. I'm not seeing any stats where the prevalence has doubled, although the prevalence for eating disorders in general, including among men, is increasing. It is not to that rate. And so that's where I try and see the positives in certain stats like this, that people are reaching out, people are seeking help. And if the reaction to this documentary that Daniel was in is anything to go by, I would imagine even more people will reach out following it. And, you know, as we go into 2022, which, Happy New Year, by the way, if you celebrate it, unlike me. And so, yeah, I found that a positive stat. If we can see more people seeking help, more people's experiences being recognised, then hopefully more help being given can come in that in-between place. Next up, one particularly key to today's guest, as someone who has campaigned so hard for increased resources and funding for eating disorder treatment. In March 2021, $3.94 million was allocated to the National Clinical Programme for Eating Disorders to establish 3 new specialist teams here in Ireland. And that's a decent chunk of money. That's exciting to see. There is still a far way to go in Ireland in terms of these resources being accessible enough and them being spread out in a way that is most effective, like in many countries all over the world. Here in Dublin, we have disproportionately good resources in this area, i.e. we do so much better for the resources than the prevalence being a capital city would suggest, compared to other places where the resources can be incredibly limited or there can be a blind spot of there being any services available in some areas, which is really worrying and of course feeds into a common issue that people can face when it comes to mental illness, that when it comes to getting support for mental illness, that you have to travel a long way to get the right kind of help. And so even with that all said, great to see there's an increase in funding. And in the episode, we talk in a lot more depth about eating disorders, about the breadth of impact they can have. And I'm also very glad to be having this conversation at a time of year where there can be such pressure on our eating habits, on our body image, on the idea of what it is to be healthy. And there's still this pervasive oversimplification on what the link between health, appearance, and food is. And it is something that I think we can all check our behaviour on. I definitely know I've had to be particularly conscious going through Christmas recently of how I'm viewing myself, how I'm interacting with food at a time when food is more pressurised, even if it is pressurised in what can seem like a good way of eat whatever you want. That can still be unsettling to a lot of people. I just wanted to note that without waffling too much, because I'm just talking into a mic on my own. So with that all said, this is a conversation I was so glad to have with Daniel. And if you do want to catch Unspoken, which aired on the 18th of November on RTE, that can be found on RTE Player if you are based in Ireland, or if you are not, you can potentially use a VPN like our past sponsor, ExpressVPN, who can make it seem like your device is in Ireland and get to watch it that way instead. Either way, that is out there, but very much an informative conversation you'll hear with Daniel today. Also, if you are new to the podcast, I would encourage you to look back and visit previous episodes where we've talked about eating disorders, or indeed any topic that takes your fancy, because these do not have to be listened to in order. And of course, every guest that we have, even if it is a repeat theme, offers their own distinct perspective. And so I would definitely recommend having a binge of the back catalogue if you're finding yourself with a little bit more time through January. Maybe you're at home more with the darker months, maybe you are working from home and so you've got that commute time back. Maybe you've not gone back to work and you're still on your Christmas break. That must be nice. Whatever it is, thank you for listening as always. Welcome if you are a new listener. And I hope you get a lot out of today's episode. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out. Emails, laundry, groceries. There's a lot on your to-do list, but what should be at the top? And what if the answer is you? This year, put yourself first with the help of Dipsy. Dipsy Stories believes in less analysing and more feeling your feelings. Less stressing and more easing into things. Less scrolling and more savouring the moment. Less pressure and more pleasure. Dipsy Stories is an app full of sexy audio stories where you can close your eyes and let yourself get lost in a world where only good things happen and pleasure is your only priority. It's a way to explore your fantasies in a safe, shame-free way. And they also have wellness sessions to help you wind down and explore, and sleep sessions to help you drift off. For listeners of our show, Dipsy is offering an extended 30-day free trial when you go to dipsystories.com/health. That's 30 days of full access for free when you go to dipseastories.com/health. Go get it.
Yes, queen.
Was that good?
That was actually.
So I'm Daniel, and I have always been a little bit anxious ever since I was a very young child. I've always kind of being predisposed to anxiety. I remember my mum She was a mature student and she went back to do nursing. And I was about six at the time in school. And my teacher brought my mum in for a meeting because she said that I was in school and I was so worried and concerned about my mum sitting exams. I was so worried she was going to fail her exams. So I was always then, from that age, always pinned as the worrier in the family, always been the way. But I think then, I suppose, to relate it more so to eating disorders, I think when I was around eight, I remember distinctly that me and my brother were doing this boxing, this fitness thing in our hometown. And on the first day of the fitness thing, they weighed us all. So they brought us all up to the front of the class and put us all on the weighing scales and then had a comment for every single person and about their weight. So I remember my brother went up before me and he's 3 years older than me. And then I went up after him. And I think I was only slightly heavier than him on the weighing scales. And this big spectacle was made of it by the trainers. And they were laughing about it. And they were like, oh my God, like, that's crazy. You're younger than your brother and you weigh more than him. And it kind of, from then I became so, and I'm very conscious that I don't want to say that's what caused it, because I don't think it is. I think it's a myriad of things. But that was one moment that I remember distinctly being so concerned about my weight. And then that predisposition I had towards worry and towards, you know, being a very anxious child, then I suppose conflated with my weight. So I would become so worried about my weight and what weight I was. And I'm conscious, I don't want to say particular weight measurements or anything like that, but just say I wanted to be a stone lighter than I was all the time. So I would, from then I started like weighing myself consistently. And this was between the ages of 8 and 10. I was weighing myself consistently at home and pulling out. My mum used to get those magazines like Take a Break or Chat and stuff like that. And I'd pull out all the diet sections and be like, what diet can I go on this week? What can I do this week? And it was very counterproductive, because all it was doing was actually was kind of, I suppose, encouraging a little bit more emotional eating than anything. So I was, you know, so worried about my weight, but then I was eating a lot of food really at that age. I mean, as a lot of 8 year olds do, I mean, children generally love food. So from then on was when everything kind of, I suppose, went downhill really for me and my weight and everything from around eight.
I just wanted to pick up there actually with what you started sharing about being the worrier of the family, that I think a lot of people get cast in that role, and it can be a way to sort of make light of something in a way that can feel quite like endearing and, you know, sort of protective.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
Do you remember as a young guy what that was like, how that label felt?
I then began to worry about the fact that I was called a worrier. So I suppose I'm a very organized person, but as a child, I was always very organized. And I thought maybe this is a good thing because it means that I'm tuned into everything. I'm, you know, I felt if I worry about things and think about things, well, then it means bad things won't happen. Like the bad thing won't happen. I used to always think if I think about the worst case scenario, well, then anything other than that is always good. But I remember at that age feeling kind of, it made me feel far more mature at the time, because I thought, oh, I'm the worrier of the family. Like I'm the mature one. I'm, you know, I'll worry for everyone and I'll do everything for everyone. So definitely it made me feel quite mature for my age at 8 years old, really. So yeah, no, it's seen as an endearing quality, you know, but I wouldn't say it's the most endearing, like, because a child, in my opinion, should always be very carefree and just enjoying their youth and being a young kid. Like, I know for a fact if I could have that time back again, that's all I would want to be doing, was just having fun. Because once you hit teenage years and adulthood, well, then there is a lot of objective worries. So yeah, I definitely wish I wasn't pinned as that as a child.
Yeah. No, I see that. It's never fun to actually be the worrier, even if it can be painted as kind of like quirky in some strange way. Yeah. And it sounds like you were really trying to latch on to ways to rationalize that, because it was so sort of all-encompassing that it's easier to find ways to make the worrying make sense and feel useful than it is to be like, oh, my outlook could be quite wrong here. And what does that mean?
Yeah. Well, like I always obviously had these emotions and stuff, but I never had a label for them. And I think that once we start affixing labels, then people become very concerned by those labels. So I never really heard of the word worry or worrier or anxious or anxiety as a 6 or 7 year old, and a lot of children won't have really. So I started to think maybe that this is a bad thing because my brothers aren't like this. You know, my brothers aren't called the worrier of the family and stuff. So there was a lot of secretive eating, and there was a lot of, I suppose, emotional overeating as a child, because I was always so, as I said, so worried, and I took things on very heavy. Like if someone made a bad comment to me in school or something like that, like I would take it very, very, it would go very deeply within my psyche. So, and that would throw me off balance for a few weeks in trying to deal with that. So I definitely think I resorted to food as a way to, I suppose, numb those feelings somewhat. And then when I got towards my teenage years and stuff, I think that a lot of it has to come down to just body physiology as well. I mean, I'm very tall now, I'm 6'4", but as a child, it took me a while to hit my growth spurt. So there was an awkward stage there where my body, you know, hadn't really evened out, and, you know, just a lot of it was down to physiology as well. And I then always thought from about 10 up, always thought that I was fat, was always upset about being fat, and thought that I could never do anything in life, and I could never get anywhere by being this size. I remember I used to close my eyes and imagine myself as an adult, and I would just see a very fat person in my mind, and I thought, that's me for life, like that's what I'm set up as for life, and I'm going to never amount to anything, which is very, in saying it now, it's very troubling to think that a child is thinking like that, you know, that they're conflating. I think it's very bad that people, you know, that we have this predisposition to conflate fatness with a lack of self-worth. But then when I got into my teenage years, I was doing a lot of overeating. I wouldn't even call it binge eating, because there wasn't periods when I was severely restricting and then binge eating. You know, it was more so that it was just a lot of the time I was eating a lot of food. And I was, you know, objectively, I was living in an overweight body as a teenager. And that definitely played on my self-confidence a huge amount. You know, all my friends and stuff were quite athletic, and, you know, we'd go out and they'd always be the ones getting chatted up, and they'd always be the ones getting with people, and I'd always be kind of standing there in the background a little bit. And I relegated myself to the background, because I thought, if I was in the background, well, then I'm not standing out, and that's what matters.
I also want to pick up on that, because I think it speaks to what you've described there, how much we are sort of cast in these roles from a young age. Mm. So like you said, yeah, it is scary to think how young we can start equating worth and size. And yet it's also all around us. So of course we soak that up. Of course, like people on nights out are judging each other based on that.
Yeah, 100%. And even I find that, even looking back at things as simple as advertising, you know, I remember being a 10-year-old and being so taken in by the thought of like the Special K diet, and being so thinking, you know, that woman in the ad. And people often have this, and this is something that I could talk about for hours, but there's this, as we know, this misconception that eating disorders only affect women and girls, and only young girls are taken in by advertising such as that. But it's absolute, like, I'm living proof that that's not the case. And I remember, you know, being so obsessed with these diet ads and these diet shows, and, you know, the way that people in these diet shows, and this is only 15 years ago, really, shows like The Biggest Loser, things like that, the way that people who were overweight were spoken to and spoken about and ridiculed and mocked, made me think that me being at that time overweight and living in a bigger body made me think that I was absolutely, had nothing going for me in life. And that's a direct consequence, unfortunately, of what these shows are advertising, and what society generally kind of perpetuates that notion that thinness is good and thinness is something that we should always celebrate. And it's funny saying it now, because even when I recounted that story to you about when we were weighed in that exercise class and stuff, nowadays something like that would never happen. And that's fantastic. Like I definitely couldn't see something like that happening anymore. Like a lot of those diet shows and stuff are off air now. But unfortunately, you know, we grew up in that time period when those shows were like mainstream television, everyone was obsessed with them, which I think definitely has had a huge negative impact on people in their, you know, mid to early 20s.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I think one of the things that I'm increasingly interested in is this idea of like body neutrality, that for a lot of us, this is such a difficult journey. And how do you overcome something that's so widespread and so insidious? Yeah. You know, maybe for a lot of us, the more achievable thing is to care less, as opposed to get to a point where we feel really great about ourselves at any size. And certainly with some of the examples you gave of when you were younger, that absolutely makes the most sense. You as an 8-year-old, I don't think there's a right or a wrong size for an 8-year-old. I mean, there's, you know, there would be clinical advice, you know, bordering that, but broadly you fall somewhere within a safe margin, and you having some, like, you know, puppy fat, as some people might call it, is a part of growing up and your body developing.
Exactly, like, like, that body neutrality point is excellent, because that's something that I would be, you know, everyone has their own, well, I obviously would never advocate for being harsh to your body. That I would never advocate for that, but I'm going for what works best for me, and body neutrality for me absolutely works the best. Like, my body, the way I look at it now, is that my body is a biological system, if we want to break it down to the very base level, and its main purpose and function, my body's entire function, is just to keep me alive. And everything in there, is its purpose is to keep me alive. And it's something that I often think about, is that when I was, you know, at my worst with my eating disorder and stuff, I was very, very bad to my body, but my body kept me going. And my body, even though I was depriving it, and even though it was not getting what it needed, it was essentially fighting to keep me alive. So now I have this very newfound appreciation for my body, because I was like, I treated it so badly, and that's, you know, what it was doing for me. So it's time that I treat it with the respect that it deserves, because, as I said, its main function and all it wants to do is to keep you alive. It doesn't care about, but like, it doesn't care about how you look in clothes. It doesn't care about societal level of anything, and how you're perceived in society. It's like, I just want to keep you alive. So I think that it's important that, you know, we break it down to that base level, is that we treat our body with the respect that it absolutely deserves.
For sure. I love that. And you were going to share, I think, a little bit more about how your approach to your body was developing through your teens.
Mm. So as a teenager and into my first few years of college, I was living in an overweight body. And as I said many times, that totally conflated that my self-worth, felt worthless and stuff. But at the same time, living in this overweight body, but being so obsessed with food, so obsessed with calorie counting, so obsessed with how many calories were in things, so obsessed with, like, depriving myself of food, criticizing myself, you know, from the moment I'd wake up in the morning to the moment I went to bed, all that's on my mind was food. So I remember at that age, like, it's funny, because I was living in an overweight body, but I thought, because I'm not thin, or because I'm not losing weight, I don't have any issues surrounding food. So I had made that decision myself. I was like, I can't, because look, I'm not pigeonholed into these specific boxes of what a disordered eating looks like. But it's only now, actually, that I've come out the other side that I realize that that's highly, highly incorrect. So I always say, if I could have my time back again, but I say that because it's important, because I think of people that could be listening to this, that could relate, that could be in a similar situation currently themselves, is that I would have gone and sought help then, you know. I would have gone and sought help to say that I've got a huge obsession with food. I'm very worried about food. I'm very, very harsh to my body all the time. And that could have very much nipped a lot of things in the bud at that age. But and that's one thing that probably concerns me the most, is that there's people out there that have severe issues with food and severe hang-ups about food, and it's destroying their lives and it's destroying their daily lives, but they can't seek the help that they need, on the basis that they're not taken seriously because they're living in an overweight body. So how can you have an eating disorder? And number two, for themselves, that they think that they can't have one because they're living in this overweight body. So my life goal is definitely to try and, not even to try to, but to remove a lot of those stereotypes that we have about people with eating disorders, because then people would feel more empowered to seek the treatment that they need and deserve. I know for a fact, when I was that 18 or 19 year old that was overweight, I was very much, if I'd seen another overweight person anywhere on television, on social media or anything like that, who had spoken about their struggles with eating disorder and them seeking help for their eating disorder, that definitely would have empowered me a lot more to have gone and sought the necessary treatment.
No, I agree. I absolutely do. And I, look back at my own experiences and how much I didn't know, and how much I had an idea of, what eating disorders look like.
Yeah.
And it was always female examples in my head.
Always, yeah.
You're right. It's crazy, the position we're in. Not only that, but then even if you do have some awareness, the societal awareness is so bad, and even certain awareness in medical communities, that you often need to get physically iller in order to get the help. And that is terrifying, because it's the last thing you need is another incentive.
Exactly. Like, what I would compare to is that if someone is seeking support from particular medical clinicians, and they're told that they're not thin enough to access particular forms of treatment. That is the equivalent, I think, of inviting a person who suffers with alcoholism into an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and giving them a drink of vodka. Because all you're doing there is that if a person's desire in life is to be as thin as possible, and then you telling them that in order to get help, they have to be thinner, well, then you're just making them, as you said, more physically unwell. So it's not even the weight loss element of it. It's also the malnourishment aspect of it. You know, when I was suffering with my condition, there were certain physical effects that I was having. I was a lot thinner than I am now, but there was effects outside of that, even when I was living in a more regular sized body, that there was, you know, constant faintness, constant coldness, no energy, irritable moods, you know, other physiological effects of that, and that was caused by not nourishing my body and not giving my body what it deserved. So to be told by a clinician that you have to essentially keep doing that and even do that worse. And I know that they're not saying that's what you have to do, but what option does a person have? If a person can't access treatment privately, then that is unfortunately the only option that they have in order to access it publicly, is to essentially become more physically unwell. And that's very disturbing. That's very disturbing.
Yeah, exactly. And you're already not thinking rationally. This is affecting so much of your outlook even certain well-meaning things that people might say to you can be taken in a very different way. And that's one of the things I heard you talk about in the documentary, how even people trying to be supportive, your mind can find ways to twist that. So someone says you're looking healthy, if maybe you're looking kind of less emaciated on a particular week, take healthy to mean fat.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And it's you twist everyone's words, and the condition makes you you become a very paranoid person. I remember I used to even think that I had a very bad flu one time, and my mum had given me antibiotics. My mum's a nurse, and she had gotten antibiotics for me, and I refused to take the antibiotics because mum was so concerned about my weight that I thought mum was giving me steroids to make me put on weight. So it and now saying that, you know, I'm a very rational person, but it's so funny how the condition makes you so irrational and paranoid. And as you said there, it flips everything and it twists everything. And, you know, the one thing that I would say is that even now, you know, as being very much on my way to full recovery, and that's the end goal, is that I still, when people pass comments about my physical appearance, it still is something that I have to really sit with and almost be like, no, Daniel, like, don't be twisting what they said. They said, you look this way. Well, then, that's their view, that's their opinion, so what? Like, you know, and it wouldn't even be a negative comment. Like, I mean, it would be an objectively very positive comment. But one thing that I would say is that if there's a person in your life that you know has an eating disorder or has recovered from an eating disorder or whatever like that, and you want to give them a compliment on their recovery, there's a myriad of compliments you can give a person that is unrelated to their physical appearance. Some of the best compliments I've received have been of my family who are, and my friends that are saying that I'm a much, you know, that my smile is brighter, that my energy is better. They love being around me. That they said that it's great that I sit at the dinner table with them and have a meal with them and we talk. And, you know, there's so much more to recovery than weight restoration. And I think there's such a focus, obviously weight restoration and getting physically healthier is a huge important aspect of it, of course, but there's also there's a huge amount of psychological benefits to recovery that I don't think are focused on as heavily as they possibly should be.
Yeah, no, I would agree. It's something that the external can be so focused on. And I think it's a bit of an ongoing problem with like stigma and lack of understanding around mental health, that when there is a condition where there's physical elements of it, we can have such a bias towards paying attention to them. Yeah. You know, and that includes like conditions like depression and so many others where there might be symptoms that people can tell more. We can really want to focus on the physical because it's still that disparity where that feels easier to understand.
Yeah, because again, as you said, it's that people have great difficulty, I think, in if someone doesn't physically see something, then they have great difficulty in thinking that a person could be ill. So as you're saying there, with depression, any of the physical manifestations of depression, people, as you said, will focus on them. And it's the same with an eating disorder, is that, you know, it's a mental health condition that, you know, a lot of mental health conditions don't have any sort of physical manifestations, but something like an eating disorder generally, you know, a lot of the time will have some sort of a physical manifestation. And because of that, people then stereotype on the basis of that. And people think, well, you don't look ill, so how can you have an eating disorder? You know, you don't look this way, you don't look that way. And then that plays into the hand of condition, because as I say, your body's main job is to keep you alive. Your condition's main role is to keep you in condition. That's all it wants to do. So it feeds into the condition, and they're like, well, that person said you look like you don't have an eating disorder, so you know you don't. So I don't know why you're, you know, thinking that you do. So we're going to keep going and doing this, and gets worse and gets worse and gets worse. You know, I don't imagine, unfortunately, that I'm going to change the world and change everyone's opinions and stuff. But I just want, you know, in life for people to remove, to, I suppose, forgo their focus that they have on everyone else's physicality, you know, how someone physically looks and represents and stuff like that. And I believe that that's unfortunately happening on the opposite side too, with regards to, I think, don't get me wrong, the body positivity movement is fantastic and it's great. And, you know, I think it's wonderful that the people who live in bigger bodies have the representation that they need and deserve that's unrelated to their physical weight. But there's some very cruel people out there that have now begun to weaponize the phrase body positivity and begun to weaponize, you know, calling a person confident. And, you know, they'll, you know, to be mean and spiteful, they might comment on a person, they're automatically pegged as being, oh, body positive, love your confidence. Whereas like that person could essentially just be thinking, well, I'm just a person living an overweight body that wanted to put on a bikini. It doesn't mean, I'm not making a statement, you know? So we're not allowing people to exist. I found that, I don't know if you know Lizzo. I remember she, last Christmas, after Christmas, she went on Instagram, she went on some juice diet or something, which I, you know, whatever, I'm not going to comment on that. I'm not a dietitian, but she went on a juice diet and everyone was giving out about her and criticizing her, and body positivity, people who are quite big in the body positivity movement, were speaking out about her, against her. And she came out and said a few days later that she has never said that she is the queen of the body positivity movement. She said that she's a person that lives in an overweight body that is simply existing and wearing the clothes she wants to wear and being the way she wants to be. And because people have pigeonholed her, because she lives in an overweight body, they've pigeonholed her and been like, that woman has to represent body positivity because she lives in an overweight body. And it's so wrong, because then it means that she is then not permitted to move outside the realm of body positivity, which I think is very counterintuitive.
No, I totally agree, because it's still making her acceptance conditional on her appearance. The conditions are just changing, you know, and I can sit here and know that it is all subjective and, you know, Lizzo may be in a bigger body than me, but I can never dance like her. You know, exactly, there's so many different variables in here. And yet, like you say, we can, in trying to find progress, just end up changing the goalposts, because then it's like,
absolutely.
So what if you are in a bigger body, you need to be a brilliant dancer. And you've got to somehow balance your size out in order to make you acceptable, is what it feels like.
Mm. It's again putting on that we're stereotyping people on the basis of their weight and their size. And that's a huge, I mean, it's always that thing of, oh, people who live in bigger bodies, they're funny. They're, you know, always the comics. You know, I mean, you look at, I was watching actually an interview with Rebel Wilson today, and she's lost a lot of weight in the last year. And she said that she's now getting more serious roles because she said she's living in a thinner body. And she said, she openly said on this interview that she doesn't think that she would have gotten these roles if she was still in her bigger body. She still would have been the Fat Amy characters and the Joe characters. And she said she had no problem playing those characters, but we're always pinning people into what they should and shouldn't do. Whereas my mentality is like, anyone that judging a person on the basis of their appearance and making assumptions about a person on the basis of their appearance, I think is one of the most despicable things we can do. And I'm not speaking here from, I'm not going to let my, like, with a halo on my head, because, you know, we all, unfortunately, you know, with people with particular body appearance or things like that, we can all kind of make a quick kind of judgment. But it's so important that we unlearn those behaviors, because those behaviors, particularly I'm speaking just in relation to body and weight here now, you know, it does take a lot of unlearning, but it'll be worth it, I think, in a few years.
Yeah, no, I agree. And you've reminded me of one of the things I feel is most disgusting about the sharp end of this, in terms of, like you mentioned, expectations for people in bigger bodies to be funny. And essentially, I think what that can read as is that you have to make others laugh to put them at ease because your size makes people uncomfortable. That we are so trained to into judgment of size that somebody else's body can have that much influence on us, that they can walk into a room, everyone notices, people want to make comments, people are either looking or they're trying not to look, and that person has to break through that tension. And I'm not saying it's always that extreme, but unfortunately I think a lot of that expectation, that's where it comes from.
Absolutely, yeah.
You make me uncomfortable to look at because I've been taught that there is an acceptable way to be human, and it's in this magazine, and next week it'll be a different weight to this week, but somehow that's an objective truth whilst being ever-changing, and you have got to counteract that. Because of what stuff that can be so to do with their genetics, things out of their control, emotional stuff they've got going on, like any of us really have our shit together.
Yeah, exactly. Like, no, none of us do. It's so true, though, and it's upsetting. It's very upsetting, and I know that from living in an overweight body and from being overweight and stuff. Is that I would have been the funny one. Like, I would have always, you know, oh, Daniel, and I would have always made a joke, almost kind of, it's almost a defense mechanism more than anything. Even though I was suffering very much internally, it was always this external presentation of being the funny one, you know. And being overweight can be a very difficult thing to deal with in society, and it shouldn't be. I'm not saying for a second that that's decided, you know. I know plenty of people who live in bigger bodies that have no problem, you know, but a lot of the majority of the time they're treated very differently to how people who live in thinner bodies are, and it's very wrong, and it's very upsetting to see, and it's very upsetting to have lived that, you know, because you know we're so concerned about that, then I think that then facilitates disordered eating and facilitates conditioned eating and stuff like that. And that definitely did for me, is that it really facilitated a very bad spiral into an ED.
And one of the things you talked about in the documentary that I find fascinating is how much we can internalize this stuff in a way that we have this narrative that is so devoid of truth when we look at our own behaviors. And so that very much came through when you talked about having dinner with your family and the kind of behaviours that you can look back on now, and the sort of things you would do as defence mechanisms, like lie about what you'd eaten. Do you mind sharing a bit more about what those behaviours were like?
Yeah, well, the behaviours then were very, I mean, as was displayed in the documentary, you know, it was eating out of smaller dishes. It was hiding food. It was saying, oh, I ate lunch, or I ate this, or I ate that, and I've already eaten today, or, you know, making an excuse. Hiding food was on my dinner plate, you know, was a huge thing that I used to unfortunately do. And what it then did is that it created, and it's, as I said, it's entirely irrational, because I would have always described myself as being a very rational person, but it's looking at this behavior and thinking, this is right. This is what I have to do. There's no questioning, you know, and looking at it now, it's like, what was that about? You know, but at the time, it's very much like, this is the law. Like, this is, you know, I often talk in related to, I'm a trainee lawyer, and I often relate it back to the law. And it's very much like, this is legislation. This is what I have to do. This is what I have to do. And there was no convincing me otherwise. It used to create a huge difficulties at dinner time, to the point then that I would want to eat in separate rooms to my family. So my family would be eating in the kitchen and I'd be eating in the sitting room, because I didn't want them looking at me eating, and I didn't want them commenting on my food or anything like that. And if I sat at the table with them, the conversation would always go back to my food and my eating. And even if I wouldn't do anything to draw attention to what I was doing, it would always come back to that, because they were so concerned. I mean, every family would do that. But now it would more so be like, the food is focused on the least when I'm eating with my family, you know, like the food is there, I'm eating, I'm enjoying it, but the conversation, everything else, you know, is much more enjoyable. And I think back to my grandmother, she lives in New Zealand, and I was over there a few years ago with her, and she was a huge advocate of eating what you want and just getting on with life and stuff. And I remember I was so concerned about the food I was eating that I have very little memories of the actual conversation and the actual time I spent with her. The memories are more so on my worry about food, my worry about my body, my worry about my weight. And unfortunately, she passed away a few months after that. And I often look back at that and I think that those were opportunities which I had to spend time with her and talk with her, you know, and those memories would live on for years, but they were totally marred. I'm glad now that my memories aren't marred by that anymore, because I wasn't, you know, I'm not willing to allow condition to take up any more space in my life, really. But yeah, it's like eating and mealtime now is very, like, it's almost a non-issue, I would describe it as, you know. It's a part of life, you know. I eat my meals in the day and I get on with my day, you know. Again, it comes back to that neutrality thing. It comes back to that I'm eating food because I like the food I'm eating, and I'm eating food to sustain my body and to allow my body to continue to do what it needs to do and to allow me to continue to do what I need to do. Do you know, like, I function best. Everyone functions best when they're properly nourished. Like, everyone functions best when they've properly slept, and everyone functions best when they've had time to relax and stuff like that. So I definitely think that, yeah, now eating out, and, you know, Christmas is in a few weeks and stuff, and it's very much like I'm excited for that. I'm excited for the dinner. Whereas before, years ago, it would have been just dread. I would have just wanted, you know, the time to be over.
Yeah, I relate to that a lot, particularly what you said about memories and how they can be, yeah, distorted or lost.
Yeah.
Because of the depth of the place that we're in mentally.
Yeah, yeah.
And could you share a little bit about what the process has been like of getting over much of that? What steps have you been able to take?
I think, unfortunately, with something like condition and that, is that the person suffering, unless obviously they're in a very, very bad physical way or mental way that they require emergency intervention, that's very different. But in my situation, it was that, you know, I was getting there, but a lot of it had to be admitting it to myself and admitting to myself that I had an issue. That I had an issue with food. I had accessed treatment entirely privately because I didn't qualify for public treatment. So I went to a counsellor, and this is what I said in the documentary, is that he made quite bad comments about, you know, the fact that I was a man and the fact that, like, he's had girls in his treatment centre who were much smaller than me and stuff like that. And I remember when I left that day, I was in floods of tears, and I was very upset in the car with my mum on the way back. And I kind of thought that this is what it's going to be like. Everyone's going to be like this, you know. And he'd very much, like, what he wanted me to do was that it was like he wanted me to, like, write out every bad thing I said to myself, wanted me to write out everything that I ate and stuff like that. And then putting, again, giving so much focus to condition and giving so much focus to food and everything like that, which I don't think now was the best option. So I left there, and my advice is that a counselor or a therapist, at the end of the day, they're providing a service to you. And if you went into a restaurant with bad food, you want to go back to the same restaurant. So, you know, if you don't think a therapist or a counselor is right for you, then I would suggest going and getting someone else almost straight away, because, as I said, they're providing a service. You know, it is like there's no point beating around the bush. It can be expensive accessing it privately. So I just think, don't waste your money if you don't click with someone in the first few sessions, or I would always recommend looking for somewhere else. So then I moved up to Dublin in September of 2019 for work, and then I found the treatment center that I'm currently going to that focuses entirely on food and food-related behaviours and condition, which I think, again, personally, was of a huge benefit, because you're dealing with people that deal with people like you every single day of the week. Whereas if you go to someone that's a more of a general counsellor that might, you know, dip their toe into ED and may have done a diploma in something or whatever like that, well, I just don't think that they're going to be as good as someone that essentially specialises in it. So I went there in November of 2019, and I think one of the reason why I gelled so well with it was that I found it that the focus wasn't entirely on the behaviours. The focus was more so on how you were going to get better, essentially, and how you were going to to mitigate those behaviors and stuff. It wasn't a sit-down session and talking about, you know, every single thing you did when you were living in ED, which I think is important, because for me, I find that those memories and those thoughts and that, and I almost think that it's somewhat, I mean, I've recounted some of it here today, and I've recounted a lot of it in the documentary and stuff, but I find it's almost like my brain has this protective mechanism in place that it's like, I find it actually a little bit difficult to remember exactly everything that I did at that time. And I think that's actually, in some ways, that because it is quite a deep trauma, it's very much like, it's almost like I'm protecting myself now by not constantly bringing it back up again. And even in the documentary and stuff, like I pulled out those diaries and that, and I would never read them now anyway. I still have them, but I would just never read them because, you know, there's nothing positive in there. And like, even just reading that, it's like, I don't recognize the person that wrote that. And it's wonderful to be able to sit here and say that, you know, to not be living in that mentality or that headspace anymore. But I don't recognize the person that wrote that. And there's a huge dissociation between me and that person, which is so funny because that's in the space of 2 years, you know, and I'm still obviously the same person, but I feel like an entirely different person. So a lot of it then would have been of reminding myself that, you know, my self-worth has nothing to do with my weight. My self-worth has nothing to do with how productive I am. My self-worth has nothing to do with anything like that. My self-worth is so unrelated to anything like that. So yeah, no, it's huge, huge, a lot of work, but I'm not averse to working hard.
Yeah, and it sounds like you've made such incredible progress. So that's, yeah, it's really exciting. You mentioned earlier in the conversation how we're recording this coming up to Christmas.
Mm.
And so are there any thoughts you want to share around like the conversation we've had on the pressures that we live under when it comes to food in a time where people may be feeling that more?
Yeah, well, the first thing I would say is that if you at Christmas, and if you don't suffer with condition particularly, and if you feel like passing a comment on what someone else is eating or someone else's weight, don't. Just don't. You don't have to. It's not going to contribute anything to the conversation. You know, like there's absolutely, I cannot think of a single justification for passing a comment on anything like that. Yeah, it's very, very optional. And I would say, don't do it. But then other than that, I would say is that even at Christmas time, there's such a huge focus on food. And it's this thing of being like, you know, it's almost like this kind of expectation that it's Christmas. You have to eat lots of food. You have to do anything this, like that, and the other. The way I look at Christmas is that Christmas is an opportunity to eat foods that you wouldn't normally eat throughout the rest of the year. Do you know? Like, I mean, you don't eat mince pies in March. So I kind of look at Christmas then more as an opportunity to, oh, I like this food. I haven't eaten it in a year because it's Christmas time again. So again, not putting the focus on quantities, but put the focus more so on the taste and whether you enjoy something. Because I find we put the focus on quantities and then it rolls around to January 2nd, January 1st or January 2nd, and straight away being like, you ate too much over Christmas. This is what you have to do to lose it. This is what you have to do to lose that average weight that someone puts on over Christmas. Whereas, you know, your body doesn't know the difference between Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. It doesn't know it, you know? So, and same as it doesn't know the difference between New Year's Eve and New Year's Day. So continue to treat your body with the same level of respect into the new year as you do around Christmas time. And again, people into the new year and stuff, you know, it is, again, a time, I believe you can change or make changes for yourself at any time of the year, but New Year is definitely seen as the biggest change. But whatever you want to do for your body, just make sure you're doing it for love for your body. And that's one thing that I think is so important is that, you know, people, I'm a huge believer in physical activity. I'm a huge believer in, you know, I like walking, I like running, stuff like that. But as I said in the documentary, and what's so important is that I do that because I love my body and I enjoy moving it. So whatever you want to do, whether it's something like getting fitter or whatever like that, yeah, not as a punishment, because it's never going to be sustainable if you're doing things because you hate yourself. Like, do it for love of your body. And even just reminding yourself of that, I find for me, changes my mentality totally towards my body.
Absolutely. And the only thing I'd add there is how one of the things I find so strange and concerning is how we have this kind of crowdsourced disordered eating around Christmas. And one of the elements of that is this mentality of like, okay, everyone needs to be eating these foods. There's these naughty foods and we all need to partake in this because then I won't feel bad. And it's such a kind of strange demonization of the food we're all looking forward to.
And yet
you're going to feel bad if everyone else isn't tucking in because then it might be wrong.
It's funny because, like, when you look at the, there's such a, it's such a dichotomization more than anything, is that, you know, you have December and you've got these big advertising firms and these big brands that are pushing consumption, 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 eat, 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 and eat this food and do this and do that and have a great Christmas. And, you know, we see the ads full of Christmas and stuff. And then January comes and it's like, that's all gone, and straight away out with their fitness stuff and everything like that. And the main function of that is just to make money. They don't care about anything else. They don't care about anything else but just making money out of it.
Yep. Yep. And I still try and do my best to resist that, but, you know, it's yeah. it's so there, and they're so good at it. I mean, even the yeah. other day, this is a sillier example, but the mm. other day I was seeing a new set of Christmas ads from Tesco, and mm. the whole theme around it is nothing's going to stop Christmas this year. Yeah, and, yeah. you know, I'm like, oh, it's such a sweet ad. I love it. But also there's mm. a part of the back of my brain that's like, God, if we are plunged into a lockdown,
mm.
to what extent is this ad contrary to that? Because I know yeah, the influence yeah. they have.
Yeah. What I would say is that, like, I'm very conscious that I don't want to be seen shouting from a soapbox, because we all, like, I'm taken in by advertisements as much as Joe blogs. But I think it's important, again, like, not to be, particularly around food and stuff, is like, don't be critical of yourself if you get taken in by it. Don't be critical if you, you know, decide that you want to do this in the year, that in the other. You know, just don't. My main takeaway is just stop being mean to yourself, because you don't deserve it. Which is, it was a very simple way of putting it, but it's I think simplicity is the greatest form of sophistication with stuff like this.
Okay, I will take that note on board personally. I agree. And we will wrap up there. We're unfortunately Perfect. At our time, but thank you so much for this conversation. If people want to find out more about you, of course, there's the documentary. You have a Twitter I find very entertaining. What is the at there?
Yeah. I'll pull it up here now very quickly, because there's a few letters. There's
oh,
a few
see, he's letters. New to the media stuff, guys.
At Daniel OBO148. It's not very catchy, is it? my Instagram is Dobby896. That's a little bit more catchy. Nice.
Love it. All right. Well, thank you so much for this conversation. And yeah, I'd encourage the listeners to find more of you online.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.